This is Radio Free Asgard.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, and this is Radio Free Asgard, episode number 100. After 100 episodes, we are still the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. We're also a proud member of the Comics Podcasts Network, so you can check out this show and many other fine comics podcasts over there. As you folks may have noticed, I've been cobbling together a new opening sequence for the show, and we're using it for the first time this week. Please be advised that it is a work in progress. We are still working on it, tweaking, making it longer, making it shorter, kind of keeping the same kind of feel as we had in the first one, but at the same time, not as loud, I guess. We had people complaining about how loud it was. So after 100 episodes, we finally listened to them and we have something a little bit different now. Anyway, so as promised, and indeed as advertised for these last few months, this is the Walt Simonson retrospective episode. But before that, we have something else. And this is something we haven't done for a while, because as you folks remember, we were doing profiles of the various Norse gods about every 10 episodes. And this week, we're going to be covering the Allfather himself, my ancestor Odin, of course, being the father of Thor, but also of my ancestor, who of course is Baldur. Not according to me, mind you, but according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And we've touched on this topic a few times in other episodes, though it has been a while. For example, we talked about Heimdall, who is the supposed ancestor of the Danish people. And we've talked about Frigga, who is the supposed ancestress of the Lombards. Various members of nobility of various cultures tracing themselves back to deities, whether it be in ancient Egypt or in Iron Age Europe. It's really not all that unusual, and of course the Anglo-Saxon, including the kings of England, trace back their genealogy all the way back to Odin himself. Now, as far as Odin himself, considering how important he is to the Norse pantheon, there's a lot of confusion about when exactly he entered into the lore. Because if you go far enough back, Odin is not necessarily the principal character. He's not necessarily the king of gods. Sometime back, I think it was might have been in episode number 50 when we were talking about Thor, I talked about how the medieval traveler Adam of Bremen, when he visited the great temple at Uppsala, described the statue of Odin as being off to one side. The principal god in the temple was actually Thor. We had Thor on one side and Frey on the other. Now, although Odin may not have been considered the most important of the gods in historical times, we know that he was worshipped at least as far back as Roman times. There's a description of the Roman historian Tacitus when talking about the religious practices of the Germans that suggests that Odin was identified by the Romans with the Roman god Mercury. Now, the reason for that comparison probably has to do with the fact that Odin is considered to be a guide of souls. He is one of the people that guides the dead to their final destination. In Odin's case, he is the keeper of the Great Hall of Valhalla. That is one of his palaces. That is where all the dead who die in heroic battle go after they die. Now, this, of course, is not the only area in which Odin is actually identified with death. Odin is, by all accounts, a war god. Going back to the earliest mentions that we have of him, going back to, you know, very early medieval times, we definitely have this idea of Odin being a god of sacrifice and of battle and of war. He is one of the later wave of gods. Remember, we're talking about the Vanir and the Aesir, with the Vanir being sort of the gentler earth-based gods, and then the Aesir coming in and being far more warlike, and this is one of those characters that came in during that time. Adam of Bremen describes people hanging as sacrifices to Odin near the great temple itself. Now, this is actually reflected in the lore. We have the story that we read prior on the show, quite some time ago now, I think it was around episode 30, of Odin sacrificing himself and learning the magic runes, the 18 magic runes that only Odin had knowledge of. In that story, Odin is described as sacrificing himself to himself. Now, that is actually, in my opinion, and probably in many other people's opinion as well, evidence that this idea of human sacrifice to Odin was based in fact and not just in the propaganda of early Christianity. It also identifies Odin, at least in the later Middle Ages, as kind of a Christ figure, somebody who sacrificed himself for, in this case, ancient knowledge, but also as a way to help his people. I think if you go back and listen to that episode where I read out that story, it talks about how his motivations for doing this had to do with the fact that it wasn't just to gain power for himself. It was also so that he would possess this knowledge, would help make him a better ruler. This story is also echoed in another myth, and that is the myth of Odin, who sacrificed his eye to gain the wisdom of the world. Remember, he tore his own eye out and sacrificed it to the well of Mimir in order to know other ancient secrets. So, obviously, Odin has strong connotations of sacrifice as well. Now, all is not death and battle and bloodshed with Odin. He was also the god of magic and of poetry. One of the other pieces of lore that we talked about in the show was Odin's acquiring the mead of poetry. So as you can see, Odin's attributes are kind of all over the place. Generally speaking, Odin is portrayed in the lore as being a wise person, a wise king, but also a little bit of a practical joker. One of the things that we've talked about in some of the Thor stories that we've covered from the comics, we've talked about Odin's love of disguise. Yeah, Odin loves to shapeshift, and he loves to take the shape of some other person, a wanderer often, or, for example, the ferryman Harbard. We talked about that in a previous episode, where he would take on a guise to have an argument with somebody or to try to trick Thor, to try to trick another character. And so Odin definitely has this practical joker side to him, which almost makes him a trickster god. Now, indeed, there are strong enough links between Odin and Loki in the lore that there's a few historians out there who actually will opine that the two characters were originally the same god, and that they split at some point in the early Middle Ages into the separate beings that they are in the lore now. Certainly, the attributes that Loki and Odin have in common are a fondness for mischief, and also the idea of shape-shifting themselves. This is something that both of these characters do a lot in the stories. Now, as for the attributes that make Odin a very distinctive character in his own right, well, there's quite a few of those, too. Odin is normally portrayed as having a long beard, not necessarily being an old man, but certainly a bearded man. We've already mentioned that he only has one eye, as the result of a sacrifice to the Well of Mimir. He also tends to wear a blue cloak and a large, broad-brimmed hat. He possesses a number of notable animals and items, in particular his eight-legged steed Sleipnir, who is often portrayed as being Odin's mount in ancient Norse art. He has two ravens, Hugin and Munin. We've also met them in the comics, but their names are Thought and Memory, and those are Odin's eyes in the multiverse in the comics. But, you know, they come to him, they fly around, they see things, they come back and report to Odin what they've seen. He has two wolves, Giri and Freki. He also keeps the severed head of Mimir, which gives him counsel. Odin's principal weapon is his spear, Gungnir, which never misses its mark. And of course, Odin also possesses the magical ring, Draupnir, which splits into 9 identical rings every 9th night. I guess that's one way to get rich. Now, we've already mentioned that Odin has 3 palaces in Asgard, and of course we've already mentioned Valhalla, which is the biggest of the halls, and that is where all the warriors go when they die. We also have the Palace of Gladsheim, which of course is home to Odin's throne room. This is the palace from which he normally rules. Now, that's interesting because that would actually imply that Gladsheim is the hall where Odin keeps his cosmic voyeuroscope in the comics, though I don't know if they actually ever call it that way in the comics. The last of Odin's palace is Valaskjalf. Now, this palace includes a very tall tower called Hlidskjalf, which has a throne up at the top. This is the high place where Odin can climb up and view everything that's going on in all of the 9 worlds. it's a little bit different from the way it's portrayed in the comic. In the comic, Hlidskjalf is portrayed as a mountaintop. And we've seen Odin up there. Thor went up there and fought that Aztec mummy thing. We've also seen Baldur up there and Frigg. So, and it's not just Odin that has access to that certain part of the palace, I guess. Now, the last little bit about Odin I'm bringing up is that without Odin, none of us would be here. It's not just me who's descended from the guy, but also Odin and his two brothers actually created the earth. And in addition to that, created the first humans. Now, according to Norse mythology, but of course, you know, that mythology is as valid as any other, as far as I'm concerned. But Odin and his brothers created Midgard, or earth, out of the body of the frost giant Ymir. Now, we've talked about that on the show before. I think really early on, we talked about the Norse cosmology a bit and talked about how Ymir's bones became the rocks and the stones, how the plants were Ymir's hair, how the oceans were his blood, and how the moon was his skull. You know, we talked about all that stuff before. Now, we also have a story here of how Odin and his two brothers created the first humans. They found two trees, or two logs, as the case may be. It kind of depends on what version of the myth you're reading. And these became the first two humans, Ask and Embla. So if you really think about it, Odin is really the father of us all, hence the name Allfather. That makes perfect sense. So this brings us to the last thing, which I haven't mentioned yet, and that is that Odin lives on with each and every one of us in the middle of every week. Odin, of course, being an alternate of the old German Woden, which of course is the basis of our word Wednesday. Now, so much for Odin in mythology. Now, Odin in the comics is a very different animal than what we see in the Norse myths. I would say that Odin has always suffered as a character in the comics from inconsistent portrayal. And it gives the illusion, of, especially if you're reading back at these Lee Kirby issues the way we have been, that Odin is rather bipolar. He swings from being very sentimental and being very emotional and saying how proud he is of his sons to being a complete dick in the case of just a few issues. And it seems like he kind of goes back and forth. That seems to be Odin's pattern. I don't know if that's the original concept that Stan Lee came up with. I can't imagine anybody coming up with a bipolar comic book character back in the early 60s, but that's the overall effect that you get, and some other writers have actually run with that. Occasionally, we get to see Odin as the warrior god, the badass, and that's something I really like. I really like seeing Odin portrayed in that way, and unfortunately, we really don't see it that often. When we get to the Simonson run, we actually don't see Odin very much at all. After Simonson's first major story arc in the book, Odin just kind of gets written out, and we don't see him again until after Simonson leaves the book as well. I don't know if that's because Simonson just didn't like Odin that much, or whether or not he was intending to bring him back at some point and was just kind of biding his time, waiting for the right time to bring it back. That's how I'd like to think about it anyway. As far as the various comic book characters in the Thor mythology, I do kind of have a soft spot for my 60th great-grandfather. So, you know, maybe that's just my bias showing. Okay, so I hope that you've enjoyed our little mini profile of Odin. And now it's time to move on to what we came here for. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about the Walt Simonson run on Thor.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
So you know what that music means? It means it's on to our review. But in this case, we're not just reviewing one or two comic books, we're reviewing 45 of them. Yes, because that's how many Walt Simonson wrote and or drew of the Mighty Thor between 1983 and 1987. It kind of seems like it was longer in some ways, and I think that that's really just because so much was going on during Simonson's run. As I was preparing to record the show, I kind of looked back over the last year of Thor continuity before Simonson took over the book. And rereading it, it's actually kind of better than I remember it. I kind of remember the Thor comic at that point being rather hidebound and moribund. Certainly, though, in the issues before Walt Simonson took over, the book was no longer really epic in scope the way it should have been. It was certainly still dramatic, but it just wasn't, I don't know, exciting. It seemed to me almost as though the writers and the artists were going through the motions. There didn't seem to be a lot of heart to it. Just seemed to be, okay, well, we've got this character, we have to do something with him. And in the year before the Simonson run, we had a kind of a long, drawn-out story of Camo Tharn and the Runestaff that I remember as being particularly boring. We also kind of had this idea of Thor and Sif living together on Earth and Sif being homesick for Asgard. And there was a bit of the soap opera stuff in there. And there's a place for all that. It's not the worst stuff in the world, certainly. Going back and reading it now, I like it a lot better than I did back then. But certainly, I seem to recall that sales on Thor were not what they should be, and probably rightfully so. If you look back at the Marvel comics of the early 1980s, there were a lot of books that were sort of consistently mediocre. And looking at my own collection, I see that I have a lot of those in my collection. I have like Captain America and Iron Man. Iron Man, I think, is probably the most consistently mediocre comic in the Marvel Universe. I never disliked it enough to drop it. But at the same time, it was almost never one of my favorites. There were a few runs that I really liked. But yeah, you know, and it was the same way with Thor. Certainly throughout the 70s, it had its ups and downs. We had some brilliant stuff in the mid-70s, and then it kind of got moribund again. And we had in the very late 70s, I think it was about 78, 79, we had this fantastic storyline by Roy Thomas of the Ring of the Nibelung, as adapted by Roy Thomas in comic book form, with Thor, of course, as the main character, of course, Siegfried being the character, the hero of that story. And I found that stuff really, really interesting. But by the end, of course, I began to feel, as though they were going through the motions. There didn't really seem to be that epic scale that you would really expect a Thor comic to have. And then Thor 337 happened. And it was kind of a shock, and I remember being, you know, exhilarated by it, and not necessarily in a good way at first, because it took me, I think, a couple of issues before I realized that what I was watching was nothing less than genius. Before Simonson took over, we had, you know, workmanlike writing, we had workmanlike art. I would even say that some of the art was actually pretty decent. But Thor was very much a book of the status quo. They really didn't want to mess around with the characters too much. You could play with the toys a little bit, but you couldn't break them. And Walt Simonson came in and he took Mjolnir and he smashed the toys. And when he smashed them, the giant sound effect was doom. Going and looking back at Thor number 336 and 337, they couldn't be more different. You have one book that's very much of its time, very much of the status quo, the Marvel House style. And the next issue is something radically different from the cover, where you have this weird orange alien who looks like a space horse smashing Thor's logo with Mjolnir. I'm sure there were a lot of traditionalists out there who stopped buying the book at that point, maybe until they realized how good it was. Thor 337 was a giant kick in the pants, and I think it's a giant kick in the pants that a lot of Thor fans didn't even realize they wanted. But basically, overnight, everything about the book changed. All the sound effects are these big straight lines. You had weird panel arrangements on pages. You had an exciting dynamic style, where before we had people who were kind of trying to draw in a style reminiscent of Jack Kirby or perhaps John Buscema, two names which really made their mark on the Thor character artistically. And we're coming out of an era where we had a lot of artists who were you know, graphically pretty good, but they just didn't have that same level of excitement as a Jack Kirby, perhaps. In my opinion, Walt Simonson is one of those few artists that can really vie with Jack Kirby for a pure dynamism that is really exciting to look at. I was reading an article just the other day, of course, yeah, I was reading about stuff to talk about on the show. And the writer of this article, it was on some blog somewhere, I don't remember where it was now, but he was talking about how he felt that Beta Ray Bill was Walt Simonson's love song to Jack Kirby. And the more I think about that, the more I think he's right. I think that, you know, you look at this character of Beta Ray Bill, who, if you look at the first four issues of Simonson's run, he defines that story. I mean, he is the excitement that came into that story. And it's a character that I came to really love. But when you think about it, you look at his design, you look at his name in particular, Beta Ray Bill. What a strange name for a superhero. It sounds very much like it could have come out of one of Jack Kirby's Fourth World comics. And of course, we know that Walt Simonson is a big fan of Kirby's Fourth World. So it makes perfect sense that this would be a grand tribute to Kirby. Now, likewise, these first four issues of Simonson Run were the issues in which he had to establish the new world of the character. We have a lot of familiar faces in this world. We have a lot of familiar ideas in this world. But a lot changes, too. We still have the Warriors Three. We still have Sif. We still have Odin. We still have Asgard. But a lot of stuff going on with these characters that we've never seen before. This is the first time we see Fat Baldur, for example, in this issue. We see that things have not been all okay with Baldur since he died and came back from the dead. We see Sif, who recently had left Thor to go return to Asgard because he refused to abandon Earth. And she's having feelings for this strange alien orange dude. I mean, this is the way to shake things up, and it worked very, very well. But at the same time, you still have some constancy. I think that, remember I talked about Odin earlier in the show, and he's talking about how Stan Lee and Jack Kirby had him be kind of a bipolar character. Not so much in the Simonson run. You really do get the sense in Simonson's run that although he's a warrior god and he can be vicious and have a nasty temper, he is the wise ruler. And we get that in spades here. The way he handles the whole Beta Ray Bill having gotten Thor's hammer away from him is priceless. And it makes perfect sense for the character. These are the sort of character notes that really make a story interesting to read. A lot of seeds were planted in this first four-issue story. We still have familiar faces, but a new take. Now, some of the interesting things about this first story are the reintroduction of Loki as a regular character. Prior to this, Marvel had been kind of downplaying Loki in the comic. He'd appeared a few times in the late 70s and early 80s, but it really wasn't like it was in the beginning. Now, probably that was a response to the overexposure that Loki had in the 60s, where I think if you remember, going back to the first episodes of Radio Free Asgard, we had a situation where they would alternate, you know, every third issue would have Loki as the villain. The cycle was aliens, communists, Loki. Aliens, communists, Loki, over and over again. But here we have Loki reemerging, not so much as the evil villain who is trying to take over Asgard all the time, but a more fully fleshed out character in his own right. A true supporting character, but at the same time, one of the major villains. So this was a slightly different take from what we'd seen before. It's a less evil Loki. And indeed, we've talked about on this show how Simonson will take these villainous villains that we've had throughout Thor's history. For example, the Enchantress, the Executioner, Carnilla. And he would rehabilitate them somewhat. It makes sense from a character standpoint that he would want to do that. Doesn't always work as well as maybe it should. I still have trouble buying Carnilla as a pseudo-good guy. Because that's certainly not how she was portrayed at the beginning. Loki, on the other hand, I think the characterization of Loki is, you know, suitably sinister, suitably devious, and that's what made that character great. That's what made that character what it was. Now, in addition to reestablishing the old familiar characters in a new, unfamiliar Simonson Thor universe, we have the revamping of Asgard. Gone was the science fiction city. Gone were the gleaming spires of Asgard. Gone were the kind of stodgy stone medieval-looking castle architecture we got in some of these late 70s issues. This was something that looked entirely authentically Viking. Certainly, I can see that Simonson did a lot of research. I mean, certainly he looked at pictures of Viking longhouses and Nordic architecture and took his cue from that. And this is not a way that we'd ever seen Asgard look before, and it looked cool. You can buy a barbarian god king living in a city like this, and the Vikings and the gods feasting in these Viking longhouses. That's what Asgard's all about, and this was great stuff. Now, in addition to Asgard having a new face, we also have some new faces in the series as well. In particular, we have the goddess Lorelei, who hung around for a while. She was actually a major part of the early Simonson run, whether it be trying to make Thor fall in love with her. She kind of stole her sister Amora, the Enchantress's shtick. I've often wondered why they created a new character rather than just have the Enchantress pull the same crap that she used to back in the 60s. I think really what it was all about was that Thor would expect it coming from the Enchantress, but he wouldn't know Lorelei. This wouldn't be somebody who was known to him, which made it all the more effective when she actually succeeded in enthralling Thor, at least for a short time. And finally, but certainly not leastly, we have probably one of the biggest changes that Simonson made, and one that I think a lot of people felt was overdue, and that is the elimination of Dr. Don Blake. Dr. Don Blake, of course, as explained in Thor comics years before Simonson took over, was a persona that was created by Odin to teach Thor humility. Dr. Don Blake was lame, and he was awkward, and he had really stupid nurses, and that's the sort of thing that the Don Blake had to contend with. He didn't have to fight trolls and giants and Loki all the time. But by getting rid of Don Blake out of the series and transferring that secret identity over to Beta Ray Bill, though Beta Ray Bill's secret identity was really just Beta Ray Bill, which was kind of weird in itself, but cool at the same time. I think that was one of the things that I really actively cheered when I actually read it in the comic. It's like really, this makes sense. Let's get rid of this Dr. Blake business. Because, it had been the source of a lot of lame soap opera subplots over the years. And when you think about it, what good a character is Blake? Now, I'm sure that since then, we've had Thor, he's had secret identities and other people as well. He can put on glasses and be Sigurd Jarlsson. Or he can become Jake Olsen. There's a lot of different things that they've done with Thor's identity over the years. And it all kind of started here. Why should Thor have this Doctor's secret identity? What sense does it actually make for the God of Thunder? And I think that's the sort of thing that Simonson thought about and said, hey, let's do without it for a while. Now, speaking of Lorelei, she really starts to come to the front in Simonson's next four-issue story arc, which to me really established that this first few issues were not just a fluke. I think that in a very real sense, these were the stories that Simonson came on board to tell. The two main plots were, of course, the Beta Ray Bill storyline, which really shook everything up. And then, of course, the ongoing Searcher saga, which at this point was just running as a subplot. Here we have something really interesting in the next story arc, where Simonson brings back an old character, which frankly nobody gave a shit about, and turned it into a much more interesting character than it had originally been. Now, of course, I'm talking about the Fafnir story. And in the middle of it all, in this revival of this kind of lame villain that appeared a couple times back in the 60s and 70s, we get a lyrical piece of character work, The Last Viking. To date, one of my favorite Thor stories ever. And it's incongruous in the context that it was presented in, where we have this giant green lizard destroying New York, and then all of a sudden Thor hears somebody calling to him from the Arctic, the Antarctic, and finds out that it's this aged Viking man, the last of his race, the last of the real Thor worshippers left on Earth. And he takes him into battle with Fafnir so that he can die in battle and go to Valhalla. And it's one of those stories that it kind of has that interesting twist to it. We'd seen the sort of similar plots before. You have a big giant lizard attacking New York and Thor goes and fights it. Thor wins. But here we have something completely unexpected inserted right into it. And here it really, for me at the time, cemented this in my mind that this is really a creator to watch. This is where he grabbed me. He kind of grabbed me with his first four issues, I have to say. But at this point, I'm saying I'm not just dealing with an exciting storyteller. I'm dealing with a storyteller with some heart. And The Last Viking is one of those stories that deserves to be placed right at the top of Simonson's run as character piece. And a character piece that really works as a Thor story. Thor's not exactly the focus of that plot. I mean, Eilif is, and Thor, of course, has a very important role to play. But it really makes you wonder about how the Thor worshippers, how the Asatru, how Thor being worshipped as a god will fit into the Marvel Universe as a whole. And of course, we have another one of these classic character moments that I really like when you have Odin appear as the Wanderer. Remember, I was talking just earlier in the show about Odin's love of disguise and showing up. And, you know, this is exactly what I was talking about. I mean, this is straight out of Bullfinch's mythology, straight out of Snorri Sturluson. But that was Walt Simonson's inspiration for a lot of this stuff. And you can tell by reading it, you know, that this is really something that he'd been thinking about. This was a story that he really wanted to tell. It wasn't as exciting as fighting Surtur, but, you know, what is? We see a little bit of that in Thor, God of Thunder. You know, we've been covering the more recent stuff, but it's a whole different world now. I mean, this is not a continuity, I think, that includes these Simonson issues anymore. I'm not really sure about that. But I think that this, you know, Marvel Now universe that we're reading about now, I don't think it's the same universe. I think it's something, you know, like the New 52 over at DC, the sort of reimaginings of these characters for, you know, the reasons of making movies and so forth, probably. But I can't imagine somebody telling a story like The Last Viking in the Thor comic today. Now, while all this is going on, we do have the continuation of these subplots. This is something that Simonson did very skillfully. He paced out his subplots in a very satisfying way, and in an interesting way. It made you look forward to seeing these plots realized. Here in the story, we have Baldur as he's being sent by Odin on a secret mission. And we have, you know, the first stirrings of Malekith the Dark Elf, his first appearance with Loki. Indeed, I mean, really, in this story, we are also seeing the beginnings of the Baldur the Brave miniseries, although I think that took about another year to come out from here. Of course, considering how it turned out, I think I would have rather had it just be a subplot in the Thor book. But despite that, we do have a lot of good stuff going on. We do have a lot of good character development with Baldur. Simonson here is bringing him out of his funk that he fell into after dying and coming back from the dead. And it's an interesting story. Like I said, I think I would have rather it have been played out as a subplot and then maybe just had kind of a big solo couple-issue Baldur story to wrap it all up. And, you know, he could still do his Sunboy shtick and all that. But for some reason, you know, you guys know I'm not a big fan of the Baldur the Brave miniseries. And to me, that's really the first time when Simonson, I wouldn't say stumbled, but I don't think it was his strongest work. And, you know, he was writing it at the same time as he was writing Thor. So, you know, make of that what you will. I really don't know how much of an impact that had. And, you know, it's hard to know whether or not this was the result of a, you know, editorial fiat to say, oh, Thor is doing really well now, and now we want a spinoff. Anyway, so we kind of go right from that. We kind of had this transitional issue about Baldur, and we have some subplots with Lorelei in the first appearance of Malekith, and we go kind of right from that into the Malekith storyline. If you remember, we had the part where he was having humans eat this fairy food and changing into yellow dust. I think you probably remember that. Now, of course, remember that Malekith's whole aim at this point, he wanted to get his hands on the Casket of Ancient Winters. Now, if there's any doubt at all now that Walt Simonson had a profound effect on the Thor mythos, this is the story which really cements it. Obviously, the Casket of Ancient Winters, a Simonson invention, is key to the first Thor movie. And we also have the introduction of Malekith, who's key to the second Thor movie. So all I can say, and I know I've said this before and I'm sure I'll say it again, is I sure hope that Walt Simonson gets a big honking royalty check for this Thor 2 movie, because he damn well deserves it. You can argue that, of course, it was, you know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee who really built this foundation that these characters are built on. You know, they invented the Destroyer. They really realized the world of Thor in, you know, the 1960s. But Simonson added a lot of stuff to it later. And it's truly a testament to Simonson's run that his additions endured. that people remember them. They remember them as key elements. You not only have the Casket of Ancient Winters and characters like Malekith and Lorelei, who stuck around for a while, at least, but you also have Beta Ray Bill, who seemed like he was everywhere in the Marvel Universe in the mid-80s, and now he's kind of not so much now. But I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back and we see him again. I would love to see him in Thor 2. I think that that would be a very, very cool story if they should decide to do that. Along with the machinations of Malekith, we also have the Searcher Saga now pushing its way to the front. This has been an ongoing subplot in the book since the very beginning, and now we actually have. The armies of Asgard are beginning to assemble to defend the Golden Realm against Searcher. And we have this entire thing is still tied up with the story about Malekith. So this is all kind of happening at once. We have the return of Beta Ray Bill and Sif from being off out in outer space somewhere where they were having their own little adventures. And of course, in the midst of all this, Simonson actually finds time to tell us a background story. We get to find out about the first encounter of Odin and his two brothers against Surtur. And this really sets the stage for this, you know, the muscle invasion of Asgard that's coming in the next few issues. The action is rising and rising and rising, and the stakes are getting higher and higher and higher. It builds to a crescendo, and then you have this epic battle in New York in which the Casket of Ancient Winters is shattered. And we have winter coming to the entire eastern seaboard as a result. And this is one of the first times when we actually see Walt Simonson incorporating this into the Marvel Universe as a whole. This winter weather that is being experienced in Manhattan and all across the world is affecting characters in other comics that have nothing to do with Thor. And, you know, might be, you know, somebody on the other side of the earth, and, you know, I'm sorry, the Black Panther or something is kind of off in Africa, and all of a sudden it's snowing there, and we get the subplot note that, you know, here, this has something to do with Thor, go read that book. To me, that's really an advantage to having this shared universe. And of course, at this point, both Marvel and DC were doing this, but Marvel was really the one who pioneered it. I mean, we had that at DC too, but it was never as big a deal. You didn't have these big grand crossovers in this kind of sense. To me, the Searcher story is a crossover done right, with the main focus of the story being in the book where it belongs, in The Mighty Thor, but having other little side things going on occasionally. And, you know, it's kind of cliche now. The whole big crossover thing has been a bit overdone, and I don't think anybody will really argue that. But, now, of course, they sell, so the comic companies are going to keep doing them. Now, if I were to offer any complaint against this giant Searcher storyline, it would be that I think it went on for a little bit too long. And that is kind of a problem with crossovers, is that there's too much stuff to tell, you know, and that makes it seem like maybe it's lasting a little bit longer than it is. Now, one of the cool ideas that was brought into this story, and we had never seen it before, but now it's almost cliche, is the shattering of the Rainbow Bridge. I mean, we not only did we see that in the comic for the first time during this story, but, you know, this is something, of course, they took right over into the Thor movie. Another Walt Simonson moment that he deserves to be paid a royalty for, because this is something that Stan and Jack would never have dreamed of. You know, how could anyone break a rainbow? You know, so this is cool stuff, folks. I mean, this is the stuff that made me love the Walt Simonson Thor. And it made me say, wow, what a cool idea. In Thor 353, we have this giant conclusion to the story, the final battle in Asgard. Thor, Loki, and Odin alone against Surtur. And, of course, that ends with Odin sacrificing himself to defeat Surtur, dragging him down to the ground where it gets closed up. Here's a really great character moment, too, because here we have Loki helping the Asgardians. I mean, obviously doing it for his own purposes, but this is one of those stories that kind of emphasizes the fact that Loki isn't maybe the sort of 110% evil villain. I mean, he's got a side to him that obviously he wouldn't want to rule Asgard if it's, you know, nothing but a smoking ruin. We also, at the end of the story, get a cute little Simonson Grace note where he wraps up the loose threads from the continuity that came before him. This was a good marker because this shows you this is the Simonson reality. We're not going back to what we had before Thor 337. this is actually crossing your I's and dotting your T's, as I like to put it. But of course, this also leaves the big question. What can you do to top the Searcher saga? By all accounts, that would be a bloody difficult job. And I think that, unfortunately, not even Walt Simonson is capable of topping the Searcher saga necessarily. And we have a number of fill-in issues, and I wouldn't really call them fill-in issues necessarily, but they're soap opera-ish. We have Thor and Melody, this sort of soap opera subplot being played out. To me, not exciting issues. It's good character development, though, and it's something that, you know, there's a place for. After we have all this big action, it's nice to have some quieter stories. And I know I probably mentioned that when I was reviewing the issues. Still interesting stuff. And he gets to explore this dynamic we have here, the Thor, Loki, Lorelei little triangle, with Melody or Lorelei being in love with Loki, Thor being in love with her. And, of course, that turns into a big clusterfuck because of the Enchantress. And, again, this is one of the things I was talking about, how the Enchantress is being rehabilitated by Simonson. Here we have the Enchantress pissed off because Melody had decided not to join the fight against Searcher and his armies, and she retaliates by fucking up Lorelei's plans. And just a beautiful idea. I love how this comes around, you know, and that's one of the things I really like about these little stories. Now, at the same time that all this is going on, or really kind of just after, we have the beginning of the next big story arc that we have in the Thor comic. We have Thor's initial incursion into Hel, his confrontation with Hela, saying, "I want my father. If my father's soul is here, I want to break him back to Asgard." In the context of the Thor comic, this isn't just an exciting story. This is actually a big event that is going to have many repercussions later. In fact, it leads to a whole-scale invasion of Hel by Thor and this assembled army. And of course, this ends with the epic sacrifice of the Executioner, the ultimate redemption of the Executioner. Now, I know they bring him back later, but this stood for a long time. This was it for that character of Scourge. And it set up some interesting character stuff with the Enchantress as well, who realized the folly of how she mistreated the Executioner for all those years. We also have some interesting repercussions from this battle against Searcher, not only in Asgard, where Odin has gone missing, but also on Earth, where we have the Asgardian army stranded and bivouacked in Central Park. This is a good opportunity for crossovers. And yeah, we do get them. We get another appearance by the Power Pack. We get the Titanium Man versus Beta Ray Bill. And ultimately, this leads up to the Secret Wars 2 crossover, which, you know, generally speaking, the less said about that, the better. But the storyline also introduces into the series, or reintroduces, I should say, the character of Curse. Of course, this was the elf that was transformed by Malekith to fight against Thor, kind of amped up and made extra super powerful by the Beyonder. And this, again, this is a character that has stuck around for a lot of years. I believe Curse was still in the Marvel Universe right up until this Marvel Now business. And I would bet you 50 cents cash, that is, cash American money, that we're going to see Curse in Thor the Dark World. Following this Hela saga, we actually have Thor growing a beard. And of course, this was the result of the battle with Hela and him being touched and all that stuff. And this kind of folds itself right into the last really cool storyline in the Simonson run, that being the Frog Thor epic. And I've enthused about that story a lot when we're covering the issues because it was just the weirdest idea in the world. What if Loki changed Thor into a frog? And it's a very simple concept, and the fact that it turned out to be a pretty groovy story doesn't really, you know, damage it in my eyes. Now, there were some things about the story I didn't like. For example, we're using mutants a lot. We're using Iceman in the story. We're using the Morlocks. There's a lot of crossover here going on, and I believe that it was during this period when Simonson first started working on X-Factor. So this is the stuff that's being crossed over into the book. again, you know, I don't know that Thor works best when you're in that kind of a crossover kind of situation. But like I said, the Thor Frog series, I give it a pass because one, it's such a weird idea and I love it. But also because I don't think anything really like that has ever been tried in a superhero comic before. I mean, this is kind of outside the box thinking and works really well for me. It's not like you haven't had weird transformations in comics before, but to actually have an entire story arc that was built around that, you never really find that with one of these Superman Red Kryptonite stories. You know, it's really something that was unique, and Simonson pulled it off in a uniquely Simonson way. Now, coming out of the Thor Frog saga, you're going into an era of Simonson's Thor that I think is a lesser era. I usually do refer to it as the lesser Simonson stories, with the stories that he was just writing and not drawing. There was also a shift in the emphasis of these stories, along with the change in the artist. Well, Sabi Sema is drawing it. Not going to talk about Sabi Sema. This is not a tribute to him. We're going to be talking about the stories a bit. Now, this was, I think, in part to the fact that I think Sabi Sema's strengths as an artist lie mostly in the superhero realm. He's not what I would consider a great fantasy artist. I think the Balder the Brave miniseries showed us that. But he works okay in a sort of contemporary Earth environment. And so we got quite a few stories here that were based in that world. Coming right out of the Thor Frog story, we actually have this two-parter pseudo-Judge Dredd team-up where we have, what, Justice Peace. And ironically, it's the only story that we have in the Simonson run that actually contains Jane Foster. I knew there was a reason I liked that guy. but we had kind of a lame story, to be honest. And he's bringing back, to my mind, one of the stupidest villains of the early 80s, Zaniac. Now, if anybody can make Zaniac work as a character, it's Walt Simonson, I have to say. The problem is, Zaniac is just a dumbass character. And I don't think that Simonson or anyone else can make that character a good character. I like the fact that he gave it a go. I like the fact that he tried it. But I didn't really like the story that much. I didn't really like the effect that it had. Of course, now we have additional children in the Thor universe. And yeah, I didn't talk about Volstagg's kids much. And that's because it's kind of a part of the story that didn't interest me that much. But of course, we have here Mick and Kevin, the twins, being transported to Asgard as the result of their mother's death at the hands of Thug Thatcher, a.k.a. the Zaniac. This is, as I said before, is kind of a cool idea. I mean, it has a lot of potential, and maybe, you know, Simonson just kind of left that there in the sandbox for somebody else to pick up and play with later. But you kind of wonder, how would this work? Would these kids actually, you know, grow up in Asgard? Would they become more like Asgardians? Would they want to return to Earth at some point? Would they then be like superheroes? Would they have these Asgardian powers? I don't know. This is hardly the Searcher saga, folks. I don't think I really need to emphasize that. During this time, we also had the resolution of a long-standing plot thread. That, of course, being who's going to rule Asgard in Odin's absence. And this is something that Simonson wrapped up, of course, during these issues, where we have Balder coming back from how many issues away? Was it like 2 years of continuity? Only to be crowned King of Asgard, apparently, overnight. Now, of course, after Baldur's coronation, we have Thor returning to Earth. And we have more curiously low-key adventures here. Thor kind of mopey and not really doing the epic stuff that Thor usually does. We have an entire issue of Thor hanging out with Italian children. It's not that they're bad issues, because they're not. They are entertaining stories, but they're really just not my cup of tea, I guess. And this takes us all the way into the last kind of overarching Thor continuity arc of this era, and that being Hela's curse. Hela's revenge against Thor for coming in and embarrassing her in front of all of her skeleton people that she has. And, you know, this is the Brittlebone Thor saga, and really the last Simonson story arc. There's some great stuff in here. Love Thor's new armor. The covers, of course, are fantastic. And of course, this all culminates in this epic, epic battle with Jormungand in an issue told only in splash pages. which, again, like I said, I think that's probably the first time that that ever really happened. I know that it's been done since. I'm not sure that it had happened before. And, of course, that being the last of the Thor issues that was actually drawn by Simonson himself. Now, interestingly enough, you know, of course, I'm a follower of Walt Simonson on Facebook and have communicated with him over there. But we actually have some gorgeous stuff coming out now from Simonson. I know that the new style that Simonson has doesn't appeal to everybody. I don't think of it as a new style. I think of it as a evolution of the style that Simonson has always had. It's not as realistic. He doesn't do the, you know, the realistic face close-ups anymore. I mean, he's definitely has changed his style. Simonson continues to be a relevant creator today, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that he had a really strong start. I mean, he did some kind of obscure stuff in the beginning of his career over at DC, and then the Manhunter is really what cemented his reputation as a talent to be watched. This work on Thor, and of course other work on Thor, and his writing gig on the Fantastic Four, this is what really has kept him in the eye, I think, and made him think, okay, this is a creator that we're going to be excited to see on a book. Admittedly, I didn't much care for the two issues he did on Legion of Superheroes. Nothing against Walt, because you know I love the guy, I love his artwork. But it, to me, it wasn't the Legion. It just didn't look like a Legion of Superheroes comic. And you know, if there's one group of characters that I like as much as Thor, it's the Legion of Superheroes, and I think everybody probably figured that out by now after the last 100 episodes. So, of course, in the context of this Brittlebone Thor saga, we, of course, had his fight with Grendel. And, of course, we have the only Simonson-era appearance of what is arguably my favorite Thor villain, the Absorbing Man. We also have Thor fighting the Marauders in the sewers of New York City, and, of course, way, way, way too many Morlocks. Now, the one thing I will say about this end of the Simonson run is that he went out with a bang, and I loved it. You have the story of Thor the Destroyer. And, of course, that being the natural extension of what was going on with Hela. We had Thor being turned into an immortal pudding and then pouring his soul into the Destroyer's body to have his final revenge on Hela. This is great stuff, folks. I mean, you know, if there's anything in this later era that can match some of the excitement of the early Simonson run, I think it's this. Does it quite make it up to those heights? Yeah, maybe not, but, you know, he was distracted, too. He was also writing X-Factor and doing other stuff, too. So what can he expect? So taken as a whole, you know, and I've been saying this all along in this episode, it remains clear to me that despite its ups and downs, some stories being better than others, some artwork being better than others, some of the ideas being better than others, the Simonson run was and will continue to be very influential in the world of this character. Simonson came and he took his hammer and he smashed all the toys and then he rebuilt them bigger and better than they were before. Simonson took a tired and mundane kind of average early 80s Marvel comic and for a brief period of time, what, 4 years, 5 years, turned it into something really special. And for that, I will always thank Walt Simonson. So here's to you, Walt Simonson. It has been a great pleasure to reread these issues and to talk about them on my podcast. I hope you're out there listening. And best of luck in everything that you're doing. By the way, his Incredible Hulk stuff looks awesome, folks. So you need to go out and buy it. Okay, so that's about it for our Simonson retrospective, and it's going to be time to wrap up the show, I guess. Now, we do have a couple of emails to read out. These are comments that people have sent in for the show. Unfortunately, we didn't get a lot of response, and I was kind of hoping that we'd have a little bit more than this. But I have two emails here, and one very brief comment here from my good friend Steve Bergstrom. Hey, Steve. And he was saying basically his memories of the Walt Simonson run are Beta Ray Bill. And his comment was, love the character, hate the name. I hear you. I feel your pain. No, I mean, I like the character and the name. I think the name is something that you kind of have to get used to, maybe. It certainly took me a little bit of time to get used to it, because I certainly didn't like the name at first. But like I was saying earlier in the episode, I'm kind of looking at it as a I like the idea of it being a love song to Kirby, and it's a very Kirby-esque name. I do think that makes perfect sense. All right, so our next comment is from our very good friend Manuel Carmona, who has been awesomely promoting our show. And, of course, he does his own podcast now, the Truthful Comics Podcast, so you guys can go check that out. And here's what Manuel had to say. He said, okay, here's my two cents about what Walt Simonson means to Thor. In my opinion, Mr. Simonson means to Thor what John Paul II means to Catholics, or what Jordan means to basketball. He saw what was there and took it to another level. He raised the bar so high that it became an almost unachievable goal, hence becoming one of the most important and most relevant people to touch the franchise, sport, or even religion. I don't compare him to what Christ means to Christianity because he didn't create Thor. I'd say Kirby holds that title. But Simonson certainly took what was there and elevated it to the stratosphere. Very few creators have even come close to Simonson's run, but they've tried. Straczynski, Juergens, Fraction tried their hand at the God of Thunder and with great success. And now Aaron is doing an admirable job so far. But it'll be a while before he's even considered to be in the same league as Simonson. I'll end this by saying that he certainly made an impression on a young comic book fan that endures long after his run ended, and that alone should be proof of his immense impact on the character. For Asgard! And that was from our good friend, Manuel Carmona. All right, and our second email is from our friend, Mark, in Stratford, Ontario, and Mark has this to say. Hi, Tom. You asked for comments about Walt Simonson's run on Thor. I'm only 16, so I was too young for the Simonson run. Most of what I know about it, I've learned from listening to your show. However, I looked at some of the reprints, and I'm really enjoying reading the stories along. So that comes from Mark. And, it's good that we have, you know, new people out there who are discovering the Simonson material for the first time. I mean, with all the incredible work out there, I think that, you know, these are things that deserve a second look. And this is really, you know, cool stuff. I'm glad to see that there's a new generation that's glomming onto this stuff and grabbing a hold of it. And of course, if this show can do anything to help that process along, I think that by doing these shows and doing these reviews and talking about these issues, it does help raise awareness of these old stories. And, you know, a lot of people have access to these old stories either on the internet or you can buy the paperbacks, the collections, the trades, go back and buy the original comics. And I do encourage people to actually go out and buy these original books. You know, some of them are out of print now, but I think most of, if not all of the Thor run at this point has been reprinted somewhere or another and therefore is accessible. And of course, you want to follow along while we're doing our reviews. You're more than welcome to do that. Okay, so not only was this the Simonson tribute issue, but of course, this was our 100th episode. And it's been quite the slog to get to the 100th episode, and especially over the last 2 weeks. I really want to thank all of you for your patience. Now, there's a few people who I would like to just shout out to and give my most sincere thanks to the following people. And of course, no particular order. Start out with my very good friend, Paul Schweikart. Paul, of course, one of the co-founders of Radio Free Asgard, the original concept, of course, that was Paul and I were going to work on the show together. And for the first 50 episodes, Paul was an occasional contributor to the show, providing us with written material and some of his own unique viewpoints that were incorporated into my commentary. Now, of course, Paul has gotten to be a little bit too busy to help work on the show anymore, but I think he still does listen occasionally. And as always, Paul, you know, you are greatly appreciated in my world. Chris Reardon, who originally got me started in podcasting. Of course, Ross Patzelt, who's been a help with technical issues. And of course, we have all of you who are on the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group. And in no particular order, Peter Van Denning, Matt Kramer, Mike Phillips, Mark Phillips, Steve Bergstrom, J.A. Flood, Manuel Carmona, Paul French, Darren Noel, Baz Bromley. Now, Basil also does his own podcast. You can find him on the Basil Butler Show. Auntie Nathan, James Bates, Eric Meador, fine artist there, Mitchell Lord, Joshua, sometime co-host of the show, Scott Coles, Walt Grogan, Sarah Kramer, Richard Castelli, Cecil Young, Valence Robinson, Jimmy Anderson, Sparky Bobby King, Fernando Rocha, Dave Gustafson, Jeff Fishman, Brian McMillan, Bill Meigs, Stephen Wooder, our Icelandic friend Robert Pels, and Dustin Fitzgerald. These are the members of the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group. And of course, if you want to join the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group, just look for us on Facebook and you'll find us. Also, a big thank you to Andrew and Michael Leyland for helping to promote the show. And last but certainly not least, all the guys over at the Comics Podcast Network for allowing us to come over there and to, you know, cross-pollinate with other shows. And of course, to all of you listeners out there who I call the silent majority, those of you who don't give feedback, you guys are appreciated too. And I would really love to hear from you. It's always good to hear from the listeners. And even if you don't like the show, I liked feedback. I really do like that. And I will read out your emails on the air. All right. And without further ado, that is it for episode number 100. Been a long time coming, folks, and hopefully we have many more fun episodes to come. Now, next week, we're going to be covering Thor, God of Thunder, number 6, so we hope to see you then. So, from me here in Chicago, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard.